and welcome to Lives and Times of the Judges, a series of interviews with former judges of the Federal Court of Australia. Today, I'm talking to the Honourable William Gummo, ACKC, whose career has included 9 years as a Federal Court judge and a further 17 years on the High Court. He's also equally well known for his writing and lecturing in law, and that's where we start our conversation. I imagine that teaching and your writing, they give you as much or if not more satisfaction in looking back at your career.
Yes, I think that's right. Yes, that's right. But there was at the Sydney Bar, and still is really, a long tradition of barristers lecturing. So right back to more than 100 years ago, there were judges lecturing. I was lectured in equity by Sir Anthony Mason as he became, Mr. Justice Hutley as he became. And this is something that was not prevalent in England. It has marked off, I think, the development of Australian jurisprudence from English jurisprudence, which doesn't have the intellectual roots that comes from having had to teach it.
You started out teaching not long after you graduated as a solicitor, didn't you?
Yes, because it now seems extraordinary, really, but there was no teaching in any Australian law school of intellectual property. That was started in Sydney by Professor Morrison, basically a torts teacher, but he introduced such a course. And in 1964, I did that course. He was going off the next year to Yale as a visiting professor. So to keep the course going, he somehow managed to get me appointed to continue teaching it. So that was immediately after I graduated, actually.
So you were, what, 21, 22?
Something like that, yeah, that's right.
William Gummo's teaching career has run parallel to his work as a solicitor, a barrister and a judge, a commitment of more than 30 years. So what was the standard of teaching like back then? Because I have read an article by you that lamented the quite low standard and the lack of sufficient teaching in jurisprudence and also the history of law.
Yeah, well, it's got worse, not better. For example, there's no legal history course at the University of Sydney now. It's amazing, really. Jurisprudence has deteriorated in the sense that it's become, as it were, much more philosophical in an unattractive sense. In other words, the role of logic in legal development is now devalued, I think, really. And Sir Owen Dixon, I think, talked about strict logic and high technique, and the logic element of it is not as strong as it should be.
What do you think's behind this?
I think it's hard to get people who want it. I don't know why. There's just been a change in the zeitgeist.
I know that you had been an excellent student.
Yes, double university medal, though. Justice Gorder and I got first class honours, but we didn't get the university medal.
But you've got over it now, have you?
I've got over it then, too.
I was reading your Welcome to the Federal Court, where someone said that you were a typical Sydney barrister. And I thought, well, what is a typical Sydney barrister?
I don't know.
Well, obviously there's an idea. And I know that one thing that's always mentioned when your name comes up is A, brilliant, B, great intellectual, C, phenomenally hardworking. I know these are three compliments, but how do you regard them?
I don't know what phenomenally hardworking means, actually. I think in the High Court when I was there, we'd have about 70 appeals a year, something like that. One would write judgments in perhaps 30 of them. So that was one judgment every fortnight or so. I don't know how you could survive unless you were pretty accurate and working as needed to be.
What about the claim that you're a great intellectual?
I don't like the word intellectual.
In which sense don't you like it?
It suggests a divorce from practical realities.
Well, yes, it can be a pejorative term that suggests that people are elitist and out of touch, whereas I presume in your ways it means that you're widely read and that you enjoy cerebral pursuits.
Yes, that's right.
Which, of course, doesn't necessarily sit that comfortably with an Australian idea of itself, does it?
I don't know about that. I think that's a false idea. I think Australians, they don't boast about it. Australians have been very resourceful and innovative in legal matters for a long time. You just think about the torrent system, for example. They still don't have it in the United Kingdom.
In his writing career, William Gummow is best known for co-authoring the scholarly text Equity, Doctrines and Remedies. It was first published in 1975. Equity, Doctrines and Remedies still remains the textbook, both here and in the United Kingdom. How did that come about, that commission?
Yes, it's an interesting question, really. I think in 1972, the New South Wales structure was altered by the introduction of a judicature system, and there was a fear, misplaced, that that would, as it were, diminish the vigour of the equity jurisdiction. That was the reason to write the book, I think. Of course, it didn't turn out that way, but that was the basic reason for it, I think. And also, while there was Jacobs on trusts, there was no Australian book on the rest of equity.
And equity has always been an area of specialisation for you. Were you interested in equity as an undergraduate? Was that an area?
Yes. Yes, Sir Anthony lectured us, and Roddy Marr gave us seminars. It was pretty formidable.
William Gummow's co-authors were Roderick Marr and John Lehane, the latter a fellow federal court judge.
John Lehane and I were in the same class at school.
Oh, that's right. And he died tragically young, didn't he?
Yes, very unfortunate. Very unfortunate. Yeah, he wasn't a judge for long enough.
And he became a judge directly from being a solicitor, didn't he?
Yes, he did. Sir Victor Windeyer was his uncle. Lady Windeyer was his aunt, specifically. So his mother was Lady Windeyer's sister. So he'd grown up in that ambience, actually. Sir Victor referred to him as my learned and agreeable nephew.
And what about Marr? Because I read in your welcome there was quite a lot of joking about your relationship.
Well, we briefed him quite a lot. He was a very charismatic character, actually. Somewhat misunderstood. Sir Nigel, I think I'm right in saying, didn't think he'd be suitable in the federal court. He thought he'd be too boisterous. So he eventually went to the Court of Appeal, where he wasn't very happy because they didn't do enough challenging work. He'd done a lot of challenging work here at the bar. So that's one of the unfortunate aspects of history, really.
William Gummow became a federal court judge in 1986, 10 years after the federal court was created. So, I ask him, why was there felt to be a need for another court?
Several reasons. Firstly, the High Court had an extensive original jurisdiction. They used to do all the work in income tax, and they used to do all the work in patents and trademarks in a single justice. So they'd sit for 3 weeks in Sydney, they'd hear appeals for 2 weeks, and then the third week they'd go into the original jurisdiction. That was simply getting too much of a burden for them. They rather liked sitting by themselves, but it was just too much of a burden. The second reason was that the Commonwealth had introduced the Trade Practices Act, which is a monumental development. And there were elements in the Commonwealth structure who didn't want to entrust the new legislation to the state courts. It was also thought that the state courts would lack the special expertise needed for tax, for example. Rightly or wrongly, that was an attitude the Commonwealth had. Of course, it might be all right in Sydney and Melbourne, but in the more remote states, it did have some force to it. So an idea was to have a federal court which would have members from across the Commonwealth, but which would move around so they'd get a blending experience on a national basis. And there was a political unanimity about it, both the Labor Party and the Liberal Party. The Liberal Party, led in this in particular by Mr. Ellicott, they were determined to do this. And after some hesitations and pauses and so on, it did come to pass. There was a Federal Court of Bankruptcy since the 1920s with one judge. There was also Conciliation and Arbitration Court doing industrial matters.
Well, when the Federal Court was started, you had just gone to the bar yourself, hadn't you?
That's right. I went to the bar in 1976, so the Federal Court was part of the structure that you just accepted. I had, as a young article clerk in the 1960s, worked on several important intellectual property cases with Mr. N.H. Bowen, QC, as he then was. He'd become the first chief judge, as it then was. There was a problem that the court was given, if you like, specific jurisdiction over, say, trademark matters, statutory matters. What would you do if you also had a common law claim as well? The answer was, and in this I wrote an article drawing on the United States experience, a jurisdiction to bring within the one matter both the statutory basis and the common law basis. I came up to Sir Nigel's chambers to seek leave to serve short notice, and the matter not only was a trade practices matter of trade competition under the Trade Practices Act, misleading and deceptive conduct, I also had added a claim at common law in passing off, and he was very taken by this. The matter was settled, so it never got to be determined. But that was the start of it all, and eventually the High Court itself, in a series of cases, gave an expansive meaning to this term matter as embracing the whole of the dispute. And that was an enormous important development for the Federal Court, because it obviously attracted more litigants if they could have their whole dispute determined in the Federal Court.
Australia is a federation, but the states are very different still and have long and particular histories. Have you found the differences apparent between state practitioners?
Yes, there was, I suppose, to some extent. But as time went on, we'd get practitioners from state A appearing in a case arising in state B. So one of the developments of the Federal Court, which I should have mentioned, is quite important, is the development of a national bar.
Because that hadn't existed before, had it? In fact, it's quite recent that you can practice in every state.
Yes, that's right. That's right. The only place where it didn't work previously was in the High Court, where you'd get people from everywhere. But otherwise, you were locked into your state.
And that must have been problematic in the early days of the Federal Court.
Yes, the attitude was, I think, yes.
The court's first Chief Justice was Sir Nigel Bowen, and he had to contend with a degree of hostility to the very notion of a federal court.
Sir Nigel, in the statute, was called the Chief Judge, not the Chief Justice. Now, there was a conference back then of Australian Chief Justices, plural. He wasn't asked for some years. Eventually, the Act was amended and he was called the Chief Justice and things moderated. But it was quite tense at the beginning. For example, the then Chief Justice of New South Wales at one stage blocked the door down on the ground floor so you couldn't walk from the state lifts to the federal lifts. You had to go round, come back.
right round the entire building.
That's right, which is childish, really. But that's an illustration of how deeply felt it was.
May I inquire which judge that was?
No. In that era, the 1970s, late 1970s, for example, the New South Wales Court of Appeal was not a particularly congenial or happy place. And Sir Nigel was determined that that would not be true here in the federal court. And that is what he contrived to achieve and did achieve, I think. So what was called the brutal joviality of the Court of Appeal downstairs was not replicated up here.
I assume when you say jovial brutality, it was really jovial for the ones who were being brutal.
Yes, I think that's right. It's changed since, of course, but it was undoubtedly an unhappy place. I remember sitting in individual jurisdiction here, and you'd look up and suddenly Sir Nigel was sitting in the back row just to see what was going on. And new judges used to be rather thunderstruck. Anyhow, he sat there for a while and he walked out and he said to his associate, he runs a quiet court. And that was a great compliment, meaning it wouldn't be the jovial brutality of the court downstairs.
In the 9 years from the foundation of the federal court to when you joined, how had it matured and changed in that decade?
It had become accepted in the whole structure, accepted and respected without any further qualms. And that was Sir Nigel's achievement. It was quite a remarkable change. It all seems obvious now. It didn't quite seem obvious then that it was going to happen. He'd also managed to attract a number of very good judges, both from the bar and from the Supreme Courts. So Justice Shepherd came from the State Court, Justice Lockhart, Justice Morling were leaders of the bar, etc. And it was a pretty strong court, actually. He'd also had the great advantage of being respected by both sides of politics. So when it came to appointments, for many years, the attorney in the Hawke government was Lionel Bowen, no relation. But they used to confer as to appointments, for example, and this was a matter of great assistance, actually, because Lionel Bowen realised, of course, that the more successful the court, the more successful his government would appear to be. So they got on very well. That was an important matter. And there was only one occasion when Lionel Bowen said to Sir Nigel, "I'm sorry, but you've got to take this particular person as a judge because I'm compelled by caucus to do this. I don't want to, but I've got to." And that's the only example I know of where there was an appointment that was not congenial, both to Sir Nigel and to the government.
How important a role did politics play in appointments and in any court matters? I mean, obviously, the judiciary and government should be separate, but there must have been certain politics at play at various times.
Yes. Well, I don't think it was particularly problematic, actually. There had been a feeling that Sir Garfield Barwick in the High Court, when he was there, had taken a rather restrictive view of some Commonwealth powers, but that didn't carry on when he left in 1981, and it certainly didn't ever take root here.
In the evolution of the court, it started off doing a lot of trade practices, a lot of industrial law, but then it moved into native title, and these are directions. Were they anticipated from the start, or were they ones that grew?
Native title certainly wasn't. That came much later. But it was an example of a new federal area, and you'd want to get it into the federal court, I think. And that was a good example of that, actually. And to this day, of course, the federal court does a lot of native title work.
You were involved in the Wick case, but that was in the High Court, wasn't it?
Yes, that was, yes. That's a very important case. People talk about Mabo, but Mabo concerned offshore islands. And there was a view that on one interpretation of it, Mabo would only apply on the mainland if the land in question had never been alienated at any time by the Crown. That was important because there was so much pastoral lease activity that had gone on. And Wick is important because it looked at this question, lease, and saw that the imperial authorities at the time had been concerned to limit the right of these pastoralists that they were granting. And the net result was, of course, that Wick gave great strength to the native title system. And interestingly enough, Sir Gerard Brennan, who's usually credited with Mabo, dissented from Wick. He would only have allowed native title on the mainland for the Great Stony Desert, I think it would be. Anyhow, that's beside the federal court point.
So what drew you to law in the first place? When you were a schoolboy at Sydney Grammar, what did you want to be? When did you become interested in the law?
I can't remember.
Did you have lawyers in your family at all?
No, I was the first generation to go to the university. And one of the most important developments in Australia after World War II was the expansion of universities in the Menzies government and the provision of Commonwealth scholarships, which produced an enormous resource of university-educated people, which is quite remarkable, actually, and has been an enormous advantage, something for which the Menzies government doesn't get the credit. And that was partly because Sir Robert Menzies was a Scot, and the Scots traditionally have had a very great interest in education. In Scotland, there was a education system from the 1690s, long before England, and that was important in all the colonies, I think. It tended to have influential people of Scottish descent.
So where does a Gummo... That sounds Cornish, or...?
Cornwall.
Ah, yes. So when did the Gummos come out?
Oh, long while ago. 1840s, something like that. And on my mother's side, 1820s. So I'm fifth-generation Australian.
Any Scottish? No, so an admirer of the Scots, but no ancestry. William Gummo's career has been one that falls into a series of distinct decades, or almost decades. 10 years as a solicitor between 1966 and 76, then a barrister until 1986. In that year, he took silk, but was also invited onto the bench of the federal court. So how did he feel about this sudden shift and the new career?
I didn't think twice about it, actually. Yes, I thought it was a good opportunity, it should be taken. And it was.
One of the things I'm interested in is that you spent 10 years as a solicitor before becoming a barrister.
Yes.
Do you think that that actually helped you as a barrister,
yes,
that experience?
Absolutely, because you were used to dealing directly with clients and you understood the sort of concerns clients would have. Very important. And I think people who've gone straight to the bar don't really necessarily have that connection immediately with the lay client, which is, of course, very important.
You had the experience of trying to keep people out of courts as a,
yes,
solicitor.
Exactly. Exactly. And discouraging some people from going to court, even when they have an exaggerated view of the strength of their case, which happens, of course. Yes, that's right.
What made you decide to jump?
I think law firms were becoming much more corporatized, unfortunately, with much more emphasis on being a business rather than a profession. And I could see that was the way it was going. Mr. Emmett, who was at Dawson Waldron, he saw the same thing. He went about the same time. It was not a very happy transition, of course. It was some time before I was briefed in any significant way by the firm in which I'd been a partner.
And that was Allen and Hemsley.
As it was then, yes, that's right.
So there was a little bit of hostility from your firm that you'd gone...
deserted, yes, that you were a deserter, yes, that's right.
That must have been quite a nasty experience, quite an unpleasant time.
Yeah, but it was very pleasant at the bar, so...
Was it very collegiate?
Yes.
Because back then, there were very few women barristers, weren't there? They were mainly men.
Hardly any.
And that's one thing that's really changed in the last 50-odd years. A huge number of women who've come into the law and prospered and risen to the top ranks.
Yes, that's right. Yes, I was in the same year at law school as Mary Gaudron, actually. But she had a hard time starting off at the bar.
I think you had to be extra tough.
Yeah, but she survived, of course.
So what were the major cases that you were involved with in your federal court decade?
Oh, there's a lot of them. Tax cases, trade practices cases, intellectual property cases.
Any highlights or lowlights?
Oh, not really. There's just too many cases, yeah.
Going back a bit to your time as a barrister, what were the cases then that you were involved with that you remember particularly?
Well, there are a number of cases in the High Court in which I was junior to Sir Maurice Byers, who's the Commonwealth Solicitor General, starting in 1978 with a case called Dowell, D-O-W-A-L and Murray, a family law case, actually. And the expansion of the Commonwealth legislative power was manifest in a number of cases decided in that period. It was also significant that with the change of government, with the Fraser government being succeeded by the Hawke government, Sir Maurice remained as Solicitor General. So there were a number of cases. It's just not useful to pick out one or two. I think they're all important to the people involved, which is the main thing.
After 9 years at the Federal Court, in 1995, William Gummow was invited onto the bench of the High Court, Australia's apex court. So, how did it compare with the Federal Court in atmosphere and ambience?
Far less congenial than the Federal Court had been. For example, in the full court of the Federal Court, we always had a meeting after each case to work out where we were going, basically. We didn't have that in the High Court when I arrived. We only had a meeting once a month, which was really just going through the list of who was behind, as it were. It really only changed in about 1997, I think. We tried an appeal called Garcia and National Bank, which is quite an important case on undue influence. Justice Gaudron was presiding because it was a period in which Sir Gerard Brennan would be retiring, so he wasn't sitting. So Mary Gaudron was presiding. And we thought something's got to be done about this. So when we finished the argument, she or I said, let's go and have a cup of tea. And the other three judges agreed happily, and off we went to Mary's chambers. And we continued that. So that was a big change in the High Court. I think not really understood by people who write about it, actually.
Let's have a cup of tea. William Gummow retired from the High Court in 2012 at the age of 70. Since 2013, he has sat on the Court of Final Appeal of Hong Kong as a non-permanent judge from other common law jurisdictions. My final question is, what makes a good judge?
Patience and capacity to change your mind and inquiry and an appreciation that every case you decide has an important effect, both for the side that wins and the side that loses. So Nigel used to say, you write judgments for the party who's going to lose. And that's a very important idea.
Well, Justice Gummo, thank you very much indeed.
That's all right. Good. Yeah, I hope the rest of it goes well.
Thank you.